Good morning. This is W.W. Chaplin speaking from the NBC newsroom in New York and bringing you the Sunday morning world news roundups with reports from here at home and from overseas. President Truman has already been at his White House desk for more than an hour. NBC reporters are waiting there, waiting for the expected announcement that Japan has accepted our demand for surrender. NBC will, of course, interrupt any program to report important news. We, America, have told the Japanese that the emperor must take his orders from the Allied Supreme Commander, seeing to it that the surrender terms, when they accept them, are met by the Japanese people. Tokyo Radio is talking in grave tones this morning, speaking of this most tragic moment in Japan's history. It's apparently preparing the people for surrender, calling on them for national unity no matter what happens. In Australia, External Affairs Minister Herbert Evatt said today that Australia regards Emperor Hirohito as a war criminal and absolutely opposes his retention as a condition of Japanese surrender. And now a brief message from your announcer.
Friends, if your car doesn't stay in service as long as possible, it's a matter of concern not only to you, but to your country. Transportation facilities are already carrying a heavy load, and if it were to be increased, the danger of a breakdown would become very real. So take every precaution to keep your car running and in good condition. Check tire pressure every week. Have your tires recapped while the casing is in good shape. Have your battery checked regularly, and keep your car properly and constantly lubricated. Take care of small adjustments and repairs before they become big repair jobs. And most important, join a carpool. Now back to W.W. Chaplin and your morning news roundup.
There is no news since I spoke to you a moment ago, no fresh news about developments in the surrender. President Truman is still at the White House. We expect to hear from him any time and will immediately pass the news along to you. And now for a direct report from NBC in Guam.
Thomas Feenster reporting from Advanced Navy Headquarters on Guam. This Western Pacific island is not the source of news tonight. We are on the receiving end. And we're sitting around through another tense night. We expect President Truman's statement in about an hour from now. And that may mean that this is VJ Day, and it's all over. There will be little sleep on this island tonight in any case, but who wants to sleep? In the meantime, Admiral Nimitz's statement stands. Our forces in the Pacific Ocean areas are continuing offensive action against the Japanese and will continue until otherwise specifically directed. Admiral Nimitz won't take any action until he receives official word from the Navy Department. So the Navy fights on and is on the alert for any treachery that the enemy might try even at the last moment. You see, the military clique might not agree with the imperial government, and this could happen just to consider some of the possible last-minute fanatical acts. The Japanese Navy might decide to commit mass suicide and shoot every one of their small torpedo boats at us, like the ones I saw them use when we invaded Luzon in the Philippines. Or they might rev up every last plane and swoop down on our naval craft in a mad dog kamikaze raid. Or the submarines might wallow silently just beneath the surface off the coast of Japan for one last wolf pack raid and then blow themselves up. At Navy headquarters, I was told that there was no change in Admiral Nimitz's announcement, and the latest Navy communique is nothing more than a damage assessment and contains no action report at all. Joe Hainline, NBC war reporter with the 3rd Fleet off the coast of Japan, reported in twice today by shortwave radio with reaction stories as to how the fleet at sea is taking the news of possible peace. So the Navy fights on the alert for any emergency. The B-29s did not fly today. So that's that. We're waiting. And this may be the last hour. This is George Thomas Falston reporting from Guam and switching you to NBC in London.
This is Ed Hawker in London.
Sunday, the 12th of August, 1945.
And while the British today are patiently awaiting the news their shore will come, awaiting it with a patience born of almost 6 years of waiting, there can be no doubt they wish it would come right now, so they could let themselves go, all of them.
The latest word from London is that nothing's in sight. It'll be a matter of a few more hours yet, and no official quarter will express itself on post-victory demands. Pre-VJ J-Day celebrations lasted until the early hours of the morning, with London newspapers today again pointing up the festivities American style. Whenever anything in the way of a celebration is about to come off, immediately that's the sign for every editor in London to send a reporter to Rainbow Corner, the big American Red Cross Club just off Piccadilly Circus. Our motto is not to disappoint, one GI told me last night, and they certainly didn't. Brilliantly colored rockets were set off. They looked strangely like the rockets used at American airfields. There were fireworks galore. There was singing and dancing. Traffic was held up as the thousands of people thronged through the streets. And even this morning, Rainbow Corner looks like the tail end of a cyclone. The paper is that thick. London hotels, too, were booked to capacity, with a record number of requests for reservations being turned down, according to some. And in the hotel restaurants, it was a battle of tables. They were that close. My waiter at the Dorchester Hotel told me they were planning to announce the news to the diners, that is, if it broke. And it would have been an exceptionally gala occasion there. Sitting only several tables from mine was the attractive Princess Elizabeth in a white evening dress, and the colorful scene was nothing if not enhanced by the arrival of three of the five suntanned sons of King Ibn Suad of Saudi Arabia. Just in from the United States, they were also dressed in their flowing white costumes, the kind worn by Arabs. Once this does break, if we all don't have a case of the jitters by then, the celebrations will be loud and long. But until it does break, as Moscow is emphasizing today, the war against Japan goes on. More gains for the Reds fighting in Manchuria are reported from the Russian capital this morning. And if the Japs do make their expected reply today, it looks as if General Eisenhower will be doing his celebrating in Moscow. He and Generalissimo Stalin watched the physical culture parade in Red Square today. This is Ed Hawker in London, returning you to NBC in New York.
We take you now to Washington.
Calling in NBC in Washington.
But there's just an outside chance that the announcement may not come until tomorrow, that it might take until then to get the Japanese note through the complicated coding and decoding processes to Washington and to the other Allied capitals, and thus bring to an end the greatest, costliest, and bloodiest war of all time. But the note should get here today, maybe this morning. The president has been in his office over an hour, and Secretary Burns is waiting in the State Department. But so far, there's been no gathering of the president's official family at the White House, which will be the tip-off that the Jap note has arrived. So this is another jittery day. The reason for the almost breakneck speed of Secretary Burns' answer to the first Jap offer is that when it was sent to London and Moscow and Chongqing for questioning, our allies raised no objection to the American proposals. Probably a recognition that this country has won the Pacific War almost single-handed, and therefore is entitled to call the terms. Secretary Burns read the note to the full cabinet meeting on Friday, and by 3 o'clock, it was ready to be submitted to the other Allied capitals. The answers came back overnight, and the note was sent off yesterday morning by the way of the Swiss legation. The reason for the acceptance, temporarily at least, of the Japanese emperor is that the Allies want to deal with a legal enemy government. That's the first reason. In the second place, the president and Secretary Burns feel that the authority of the Japanese emperor will greatly simplify the occupation problems of feeding the half-starved civilian population of Japan, demobilizing Japanese armies, and rescuing the 16,700 Americans now held prisoner by the enemy. That the Japanese people will carry out, in an orderly way, any orders that come through the emperor, where there might be chaos if those orders came directly from the American Allied commander. The way it was put to me was that President Truman feels we can afford to leave some little authority with the emperor if we get what we want. The government here, however, has no illusions about the actual power of the emperor. It knows that Hirohito has been a figurehead all along, that until now the power, most of it, has been in the hands of the warlords. I'm told now that Japanese business and industrial interests are taking over to save something for themselves, and also that they're ready to do whatever we tell them to do through the institution of the Emperor. And according to my sources of information, there'll be some big changes made in Japan, as many and as drastic as the changes being made in Germany right now. The Constitution may be changed to allow a democratic government to build in Japan, and there's almost certainly going to be some drastic overhauling of the Japanese educational system to root out the last vestige of the Japanese variety of fascism. On the home front, peace is breaking out all over the country. The War Department has stopped railroad shipment of ammunition to Pacific Coast ports. The War Department says there's enough ammunition in the Pacific to meet any immediate needs. Army experts figure that 5 million men will go back to civilian life within 12 months after VJ Day. The point score, which now stands at 85, is expected to take a sharp cut. The slash in shipbuilding announced by War Mobilizer John Snyder, 95 Navy ships costing way over $1 billion, is only the beginning. In the next few days, Snyder will announce cutbacks in food and munitions right and left. I'm told there'll be some foods taken off the ration list, and that there'll be cuts in the point values of many others. But all this news is being channeled through Snyder, who's rapidly becoming more of a reconversion chief than a war mobilizer. This morning, UNRWA says it's planning to ship 800,000 tons of food and other supplies to China as soon as it can get the ships. This morning, Undersecretary of State Grew says we're sending over 1 million tons of coal to Europe this month. And in an NBC broadcast last night, he said the key to the whole situation, to food, transportation, and industry, is coal. The whole European economy is starved for coal. This morning, congressional leaders Senator Barkley and McCormick over in the House are summoning their committees back to town to whip emergency bills into shape so that Congress can go to work after the day after Labor Day. One of the bills will be to raise emergency unemployment benefits to $25 a week all over the country. Another will be the explosive full employment bill. And this morning, the Army says that it kept such a tight guard on the work of developing the atomic bomb that even J. Edgar Hoover's FBI men who guarded the plants had to show special passes. Ed in Washington, returning you now to New York.
We've heard this morning direct reports by George Thomas Folster in Guam, from Ed Harker in London, and Leif Ed in Washington. And now, a word from your announcer, after which I'll be back with more news.
We have just presented the World News Roundup as part of NBC's extensive coverage of the news. During these momentous days and in the days to come, you can always rely on NBC for complete, accurate, unbiased, and prompt coverage of all the news. Throughout the United States, NBC news staffs are on the alert, standing by and ready to bring you the big news the moment it happens. And overseas, NBC's extensive staff of foreign reporters are prepared to bring you any news that develops direct from the scene. Just as news is a 24-hour proposition, so is the work of our news staffs. For key posts throughout the world are fully staffed day and night. Remember, you can enjoy the excellent entertainment on NBC, secure in the knowledge that you won't miss any big news, for we will interrupt any and all programs to bring you the news swiftly the moment it breaks. Now back to the NBC newsroom.
There is no last-minute news as yet from the White House since you heard Leif Ed speak to you direct from Washington, but we are watching. Radio reporters and executives are spread all over the world. In fact, I've just received word that the Party of American Radio Executives, which is touring Europe at the invitation of the Army, has arrived at Prestwick, Scotland. NBC men are spread all over the world waiting for the news that you're waiting for, and it will be given you just as soon as we get it. Radio Tokyo says that 75 Super Fortresses, B-29s, accompanied by 30 Thunderbolt fighters, attacked two coastal cities on the island of Shikoku Sunday morning. Allied sources have not confirmed reports of any air raids by Super Forts during the Jap peace negotiations. And that's your Sunday morning World News Roundup. This is W.W. Chaplin speaking from the NBC newsroom in New York.
This is the National Broadcasting Company.
NBC brings you timely and accurate news broadcast throughout the day. For all the news all the time, keep tuned to NBC. Right now, listen to Kenneth Banghart and his summary of the latest news gathered from all over the world in the NBC newsroom. Keep tuned to NBC for the latest happenings of the day over this station, WEAF, NBC in New York.
Good evening, everyone. It's 11 o'clock, and this is Kenneth Banghart reporting with the 11 o'clock news, a 15-minute summary of today's major worldwide developments up to this moment. As you undoubtedly know, there's been a great flurry of excitement this past hour and a half, rumors, false flashes, denials, etc. Now, here are the facts as we have them in the NBC newsroom here in New York. Less than half an hour ago, the White House denied that Japan had surrendered. The statement was issued by Presidential Secretary Charles G. Ross, who said, and I'm quoting Mr. Ross now, "The President has not announced that Japan has accepted surrender terms. There is nothing to the story. Nothing has been received by the President, the War Department, the Navy, or the State Department," unquote. Reports that Japan had surrendered were flashed to the nation shortly after 9:30 Eastern wartime tonight. It was the first false peace rumor in connection with VJ Day, and it resulted from a report on United Press Association teletype machines. The flash was carried at 9:34 p.m. Radio stations immediately put it on the air. In less than 2 minutes, but before the damage could be remedied, the United Press denied the flash. A check had already been made of the NBC newsroom in Washington, which showed that the report was untrue. And now the United Press has just come through with an explanation for that report. And here's the text of that explanation. New York. A vicious prank touched off a premature celebration of VJ Day tonight. A person still unknown obtained access to a UP news wire at 9:33 Eastern wartime, flashed to the nation a false report that President Truman has announced Japanese acceptance of the Allied surrender terms. The false report carried a Washington dateline but did not originate in the UP's Washington bureau. It was held up 2 minutes later by UP, which started an immediate investigation. The UP said a complete report will be made. That's the end of the text. Incidentally, they added just a few minutes later, an immediate investigation was started with the Federal Bureau of Investigation and the Federal Communications Commission were also asked to assist. This, then, is the situation at present. The White House has denied any acceptance by Japan of the Big Four peace terms. The shooting war is still in progress, emphasized by bombs over Tokyo and Russian advances in Manchuria. There is nothing but silence from Tokyo. It is now more than 24 hours since the Allied response to Japan's conditional peace offer was transmitted to Tokyo. It is also just a week ago tonight since the first atomic bomb dropped on Japan. The White House said this afternoon that the war is still in progress, and that if no answer were received by midnight from Tokyo, there would be no announcement until tomorrow morning. It has also been outlined by the White House just what will happen when Japan surrenders. The answer from Tokyo will mean an immediate consultation among Washington, London, Moscow, and Chongqing. The announcement of acceptance will be made simultaneously in the four capitals, with President Truman himself making the Washington disclosure. Arrangements will be made at once for Japan to sign a surrender document. Now, this may take 2 or 3 days. After the signing, President Truman will proclaim VJ Day and immediately address the nation by radio. The end of the war will be marked officially in Washington, but cessation of hostilities will be a military problem which has to be worked out in the field, of course. The transmission of surrender acceptance, when it does come, must be made from Tokyo to Switzerland and thence to the United States. The State Department in Switzerland has already shut down for the night. However, Tokyo is holding open its communications to Geneva. Less than 4 hours ago, a message came over, quote, "Please continue contact Geneva, Tokyo." That was at 8:30 a.m. Tokyo time. 2 hours previous to that, another message had been sent. "Our important message not yet on hand," said Tokyo to Switzerland, and continued, "We suppose this message will be coming this morning." That's this morning Tokyo time, of course. Reports from Washington say now that Secretary Burns is in bed. He conferred for 40 minutes with President Truman early this evening, but refused to make any comment whatsoever after that meeting. Mr. Truman also conferred with Archibald MacLeish, the Assistant Secretary of State, who frequently has a hand in composing American diplomatic messages. Results of that conference were not announced. While Japan delayed its answer to the Big Four surrender offer, American and British pilots resumed their operations against the Tokyo area. The Allies have been alerted for a possible treachery on the part of the Japanese. Although 20th Air Force planes and the carrier forces had given Japan a respite from their assaults after the initial peace bid on Friday, the Japs, it seems, were making no truce. Instead, the enemy attacked. Jap planes struck at our fleet units idling at anchor in Buckner Bay there on Okinawa. At least one of them scored a hit with an aerial torpedo on a major U.S. war vessel. The communique from Admiral Nimitz does not name the vessel, and it says further that damage has not yet been determined. That term major vessel, however, indicates that it was either an American battleship or a large carrier which was hit. 12 hours later, a light aircraft went after Tokyo, and according to the communique, the attack is still in progress. Several hundred carrier planes are making the assault. Superfortress bombers in the Marianas are also alerted, although no new attacks have been announced. The enemy radio says in an unconfirmed broadcast that 70 American superforts made an attack today on Matsuyama. It's an industrial city on Shikoku Island. The big planes were accompanied by fighter escorts, said Tokyo. No indication was given as to the damage inflicted. Reports from the Pacific say today that if the Japs do not surrender, they must prepare for one of the most terrible aerial poundings ever conceived. Superforts, over a period of 5 weeks, could duplicate the damage it once required them 5 months to inflict, due to enlarged forces now based there in the Pacific. There's been no let-up in the aerial activity of the Far Eastern Air Force, it was announced in Manila. More than 400 bombers and fighters left a trail of fires and sunken ships in the Japanese area on Saturday. That strike was made despite Japan's offer to surrender, and the attacks have been ordered to continue until the ceasefire order comes. Included in this new total of victims were a destroyer, a submarine, and 11 merchant ships. The main blow was thrown against the Kyushu city of Kurume. It's a manufacturing center of some 90,000 population. Demolition and incendiary bombs were unloaded on Kurume, with the resulting smoke so dense that succeeding waves of bombers had to veer away and look for other targets. Other planes hit the naval base at Kure and set an oil refinery ablaze in that area. Round-the-clock strikes were also made at Formosa, touching off large fires and disrupting transportation generally there. And still other planes ranged along the Chinese coast, striking both Shanghai and Hong Kong. Another loss by the American fleet was announced by the Navy tonight. The destroyer Drexler, which was hit by two Jap suicide planes off Okinawa on May the 28th. The Drexler sustained more than 200 casualties, more than 50% of her personnel, including 158 killed. Next of kin have been notified. Among the wounded was the Drexler's skipper, Commander Ronald Lee Wilson of Marion, Illinois. Commander Wilson, describing the attack, said that the first kamikaze plane struck the Drexler amidships, cutting off her power and starting large gasoline fires. A second plane attempted to hit the ship, but was shot down by the Drexler's own crew. A third was also shot down, and then the fourth attacked, made two passes over the deck and was badly damaged but not knocked out. The Jap plowed into the after stack, and a big explosion rocked the Drexler. She sank within 49 seconds after that plane hit. Russian forces made an amphibious landing on the Korean Peninsula today, and they captured the great Jap naval base at Rashin, R-A-S-H-I-N, Rashin. Reports of new Soviet gains came from both Moscow and Tokyo as the Red Army continued to ignore any possible surrender negotiations which may be in progress. In Manchuria itself, Russian troops continue their threat to cut off 500,000 Japanese men by a great pincers movement. The amphibious operation was carried out by Russian Marines who went ashore on Korea 90 miles southwest of Vladivostok. The Marines quickly took over the naval base along with the neighboring port of Yuke following a bombardment by the Russian Pacific Fleet. Red Army planes had already softened up the areas with tons of explosives dropped during a 3-day aerial operation. Rashin was the best enemy port in Korea, and it was used as a terminal point for Japanese war goods en route to Manchuria. And on the Manchurian front, Moscow announced that the Russian troops had gained from 9 to 22 miles in their march toward Harbin. Red Army headquarters did not confirm Japanese reports that a massive new Russian drive threatens to split 1.5 million NIP troops into two huge pockets. Tokyo simply said the new drive was launched in Outer Mongolia and swept across Chinese Inner Mongolia toward the Yellow Sea. The Russian troops are moving across an old caravan route toward Lindsay. It's an air base in southern Manchuria. And squadrons of Russian bombers are battering Japanese rail junctions ahead of these advancing Red Armies. An offensive in support of the Red Army drive has been ordered by the Chinese communist leader, General Chu Tae, who told his troops in North China to invade Manchuria and be ready to accept the surrender of Jap forces in that area. Now, that order was opposed by Generalissimo Chiang Kai-shek, who urged the communist forces to remain in their posts and wait for further orders. Chiang also sent a message to Chu Tae, ordering him never again to take independent action. Chungking announced today that Chinese forces in Guangxi province are now within 5 miles of cutting the enemy's escape route up the Guangxi-Hunan Railway. Chinese forces have also captured the city of Chuansen. It's about 66 miles northeast of Kuilin. And in support of the Chinese ground forces, American 10th Air Force planes went into action today, blasting the Jap troops retreating from that Chuansin sector. All planes returned safely. At Chungking, an army spokesman issued a formal denial today that any ceasefire order had been given to Chinese forces since the Japs made their first surrender offer. Chungking said that all commanders have been ordered to continue hostilities. The Japanese similarly are continuing their military operations, contrary to a report circulated here in New York last night that these had been halted. And a British broadcast heard here in New York by NBC said that some Japanese units in Manchuria already had surrendered to Chinese communist forces. Colonel James Roosevelt, the eldest son of the late president, has been put on inactive status with the United States Marines as a result of a recurring stomach disorder. Colonel Roosevelt, who is now 38 years old, has braved enemy fire in the Mediterranean, the Central Pacific, and the Philippines during his 5 years with the Marines. He is now on terminal leave at Beverly Hills, California, pending completion of his discharge. Before the war, Colonel Roosevelt was an official observer in the Mediterranean, and he was stationed on Crete when the Germans landed there. Out in the Pacific, he was executive officer to Colonel Evans Carlson in that famous Marine raid on Macon Island, winning the Navy Cross and the Silver Star. General Dwight D. Eisenhower and Premier Joseph Stalin stood side by side on a reviewing stand in Moscow's Red Square today, and they watched a spectacular parade of 40,000 Soviet athletes march through that square. It was the first civilian festival for Russia since the war began, and the American leader watched it from the tomb of Lenin. He was accompanied by the American ambassador, Averill W. Harriman, and his son, Lieutenant John Eisenhower. Prime Minister Clement Attlee tonight pledged British cooperation with the proposal of President Truman that the secret of the atomic bomb be guarded until complete control of the devastating weapon is achieved. Attlee, who returned to No. 10 Downing Street from the country today, said that the results of the atomic bombing show the weapon must not be used for the wreaking of measureless havoc on the globe. The British government, he said, will cooperate fully with American plans to control the production and the use of the atomic bomb. Political activity continues in Berlin, where four political parties held a united front meeting today and declared that the German people would try to fulfill the terms of the Potsdam Declaration. The communists, social democrats, Christian democrats, and liberal democrats were represented at this meeting, which urged the remaking of the German character. 6,600 more American troops arrived back in New York today, with more than half of them aboard the transport Santa Rosa. All were eager for the latest news of the Japanese surrender negotiations, as are we all. The returning troops included members of an Army Air Forces band which had been overseas for 14 months, which is still saddened by the loss of their great leader, Glenn Miller. Also arriving today were 158 Japanese diplomatic personnel who were captured in Germany. They were interned at Ellis Island. Coming into New York tomorrow will be eight more ships with 6,000 American personnel aboard. And somewhere in that group will be the 1 millionth serviceman to return to the United States since VE Day more than 3 months ago. Well, with all this waiting for the final word from Japan, there's still news of baseball. And in the sports world today, the Brooklyn Dodgers held second place in the National League for a brief spell after defeating St. Louis 7-3 in the first game of a doubleheader. But they dropped back into third after losing the second to the Cardinals 3-0. The league-leading Chicago Cubs took a pair from last-place Philadelphia, 4-3 and 12-6. New York's Giants also won two from Cincinnati, 3-2 and 6-5, pulling both games out of the fire with eighth-inning rallies. Boston won the first game from Pittsburgh, 7-6, but they dropped the second, 3-0. Over in the American League, the Detroit Tigers held on to first place with a double win over the New York Yankees, 9-6 in the opener, which went 11 innings, by the way, and 8-2 in the second. Washington fell two games behind the Tigers as it split with St. Louis, winning the first 9-5, but dropping the second 4-1. Dave Ferris won his 19th game of the season out at Cleveland as Boston's Red Sox took the first tilt 7-1, although the Indians won the second 8-2. Philadelphia blanked the Chicago White Sox 7-0, but they lost the nightcap 5-3. Now a word about the weather. The weather forecast for New York City and vicinity, cloudy tonight and tomorrow, also warm and humid, I'm sorry to say, rain tomorrow afternoon. The temperature at Radio City right now is 75 degrees, although that does not reflect the temperature of our NBC newsroom. The humidity is 69%. And that's the latest news from the NBC newsroom in New York. Kenneth Banghart reporting. I'll be back with you tomorrow night at the same time. Until then, good night.
Kenneth Banghart and the news has come to you from the NBC newsroom in New York. Keep tuned to your NBC station for the later news. This is the National Broadcasting Company.
9 o'clock Eastern Wartime, WEAF, New York.